just want to welcome you to our event. This is the first joint session of IEEE Computer Society with the SoCal SPIN and also the INCOS. So I want to welcome you. And first thing I want to know, everybody signing the roster, this one? We want to make sure, so you're in there. Okay, so make sure you sign. So we have two people that
are
signed.
Are you going to pass it around?
But let me give it to John. So John, go ahead and. This is one of the biggest turnout we had so far, so we might be continue with the joint session. It's working out,
I guess. Aggregate people.
Right, from different angles.
Yes.
So as you know, our topic is about the Agile, which is Dr. Palmer's gonna discuss about, so I'm not gonna get into it. So you have the stage then.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So my name is Kent Palmer, and today we're going to be talking about Agile at Scale. And so to just jump right in, you know, once we've established many working Agile teams in an organization, then the question is, what's next, right? So this briefing is to try to answer that question with one particular answer. So, you know, I mean, one of the things that we can do on larger projects is introduce lean ways of working to make things more efficient, and then we can make the organization a more friendly environment for the Agile teams by introducing something called servant leadership. But another possibility is to re-engineer the organization to make the organization as a whole Agile, and that's called scaling Agile. So that's what our topic is today.
And if you think replacing the organization is good.
Good point. Okay, so there is a book that was just published that kind of introduces this subject very well, and I took some diagrams out of Charles Cobb's book, and which I think really puts the best face on you know, what are the possibilities that are facing us here. And so basically in this diagram here, he's saying that, you know, if you go from waterfall over to Agile, there's a gap, right? And so one of the things that you're going to do is move toward increasing agility. But basically what he's saying is that there's a lot of possibility for hybrid solutions between the two extremes, right? Which is what this figure three is saying. You know, he's saying you have the traditional plan-driven management today and Agile down here in the lower right-hand corner, and so there's going to be these new hybrid approaches and new enterprise-type approaches to the organization. And so then what he does is that in the third figure, he shows that, you know, there's some models out there. You know, there's the managed Agile development framework, disciplined Agile delivery framework, scaled Agile framework, lean startup. So there's these different models that have been created of what an Agile organization looks like at the global scale. And so we're just going to concentrate on one of those. And so I'm going to concentrate on the Leffingwell one because that's the model that I know the best. But in his book, he talks about his own model, which he calls the Managed Agile Development Framework. And then Ambler has the Disciplined Agile Delivery Framework. And then RISE has Lean Startups. So I just want to give you a picture that there's a field of possible approaches out there. And we're just going to look at one, which I think is an interesting solution.
Excuse me. Do you visualize it in an actual practice of mapping this to a large scale project, that what you would really be doing is maybe adapting the best practices of each of those individual focus techniques? For instance, the discipline agile most likely would, if you had system critical, like safety mm-hmm. critical or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's why he developed his is because he was working in an environment which was kind of safety critical or had some kind of standard that it had to align to, whereas these others don't have anything to do with standards really. They're trying to develop their own standards for agile development.
I'm just curious what your intuition.
Well, what he's saying back here.
Emerging.
Let's see if it works. What he's saying is there's going to be all kinds of hybrid approaches.
Yeah, I guess that's my point.
And so the thing is that what's happening is this is a design space, and there's some point solutions that already exist in that design space. And so we're looking at some point solutions. And in this briefing, I'm just giving an example of one of those that I think is a good one, but that covers a lot of the territory. But really, you need to, there's about five or six authors out there who have tried to develop these frameworks, and I'm going to talk about one of them here, which is Craig Larman and Bas Vode. They wrote this book, Scaling Lean Agile Development, and their advice at the beginning of the book is don't scale, right? Agile is for small teams, and don't do it on any large scale, right? And I've got the quote here that they have at the beginning of their book. They just say, don't do it. But there's a 300 or 400-page book there that says, if you're going to do it, well, here's a few things that I ought to tell you. So anyway, the point is that since the projects that we're doing are getting bigger and more complex all the time, and the organizations are getting bigger, mostly through mergers mm-hmm. these days, not scaling is just, not an option. We've got to come up with some scaling solution. And so we're going to talk about one of those. So the one we're going to talk about is one from Dean Leffingwell, and it's called the Scaled Agile Framework. And so, basically, he has a book called Agile Software Requirements that was published in 2011. He had a book before that, Scaling Software Agility. But now he's moved to having a website called scaledagileframework.com. And basically, the big picture that he is trying to get across is on that website. So you can go there, and we're going to look at it in a minute. And but then he's, because we've kind of reached a tipping point, it seems to me, where a lot of companies are deciding to go agile at scale or have a large, institute a lot of agile teams. His approach is kind of the front runner of all of these approaches that are being adopted right now. And so it's good to look at his particular approach because it is kind of the market leader. And because it's the market leader, he can have a certificate program and train consultants in his approach, right? So he's like the first to have a certificate program for this kind of thing. And so that's the way you can see that he is the market leader. So this is the book. And basically, this book has been outrun by the website. I mean, they're constantly changing this website almost on a daily basis. It's hard to keep up. Yeah, and so the thing is that, but he talks about, the parts of the book is he talks about his big picture, which is basically layers of the organization. And then each section is about the team, about the program, and about the portfolio level of R&D. And so this is kind of the high-level contents of this book. And then when he comes out and talks, basically the thing that he says, one of the things he says is that, his framework is just the facade for the work of Don Reinertsen, right? And this book here called Flow. And Reinertsen's, what he's trying to do is establish what he calls second generation lean product development. And so these are the themes that this book is organized around. You know, taking an economic view, queues, variability, batch size, work in process constraints, cadence, synchronization, and flow, fast feedback, and decentralized control. So this book is hundreds of principles. He has under each of these sections, he'll have, you know, maybe 20, 30 principles that he's trying to get across in his book. And I didn't read this book originally, even though I followed Don's work for years, because I thought it was just maybe a rehash of what he had said before. But actually, this book is worth reading because it is has a lot of good content, and he's formulated it in a really interesting way. And so Leffingwell said that his manuscript, he had finished his manuscript when this book came out, and he had to go back and rewrite his manuscript in order to incorporate the principles that Don Reinertsen's talking about. So really, in this model, there's two levels to it. There's kind of the facade, and then there's what's behind that facade. And what's behind the facade are these ideas of Reinertsen. So this is a schema, kind of schema of the big picture, right? And so basically what it says is that there's three levels to the R&D organization. You've got your agile teams, you know, doing Scrum. They have their backlogs. But then what
does backlog mean in this context?
Okay, so the backlog is the kind of list of the work to be done, mm-hmm. right? And so the idea is that there are these narratives that you're doing your work by, and they contain, you know, the requirements, basically. And so at each level, there's a different kind of narrative in Leffingwell's approach. So there's stories at the team level, but at the program level, there's features, and at the portfolio level, there's epics. So you have your agile teams doing Scrum with backlogs, but the idea is that you want to get those teams running, and you want to get them to have their cadence, and they want to know their velocity, and you want them to be working as agile teams. But the problem that comes up is that once they get going, they outrun the organization. In other words, the organization cannot keep their backlogs full. And so the problem becomes, the pressure comes to the organization to reorganize so that they can keep the backlogs of these teams full. And so if you pay attention to the advice of Leffingwell, basically he'd say, you really only want to move up to this next level when you can't keep those backlogs full, when your teams have started to outrun your organization, so that you're forced into this. But of course, some companies are just deciding, well, we're going to go agile at scale. And so what they do is a vice president or somebody sends out an email to the whole company, says, you guys are agile from now on. You didn't realize it, but you are agile. And so that tends to cause a lot of confusion, because what happens is that everyone goes out and reads books on agile, and they go out and read books on lean, and they all come up with different interpretations of that, and that means different things to different people, and it starts to create confusion in the organization. And so one of the values of a model like this is that it establishes a common vocabulary. It gives a picture of what, the organization might look like in the future if it became more agile. And so that's kind of the value of this this approach. But anyway, the next level up is the program level, where you have the products, programs organized around products. And so Leffingwell's idea is this would also be a Scrum team with a backlog, right? But they are not producing working software. They are producing features, story features, that are ready, that can be pulled from the program backlog into the team backlogs to be executed.
Is that like marketing?
Okay, that's where we get to the portfolio level, right? So this is at this level, you've got your, if you have an organization with multiple products, right? These are, this is the program level. And the other thing that's happening at this program level is what he calls release train planning and supervision. So the idea is that if you have a large project that has multiple teams that need to synchronize, you need to do that. And one of the things about Agile is that, you know, you have this idea that, okay, all these teams are running at their own velocity and they're more or less producing at their own speed and they have their own story points. And so it's hard to compare Agile team to Agile team. So what release planning does is it allows on large projects to figure out what is the common denominator to understand how these teams can synchronize their deliverables to deliver common features.
One thing I'm unclear about, there was almost an implication that the Scrum team started off with a backlog, but you didn't say that that backlog actually derived in a similar fashion from features and ultimately from the ethics.
So a lot of times what happens is that you have it depends on what the situation is. If you've got products that are already being delivered and you decided to go Agile, right, you will kind of know what it is that we're doing. But if you're starting off with a new development, right, then it's better if you go through this derivation process, right? But basically what happens now is that people put stories in the backlog. I mean, you know, anyone can put a story in the backlog. It may not stay there for very long. But
I was just wondering what feature that came from.
Yeah. So, but you make a good point. What he's trying to do is he's trying to rationalize the process by which things get into backlogs of teams in organizations. So, because it happens kind of by magic now, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. So the next level up to talk about is the portfolio level. And they're the ones who, you know, all the ideas are coming in, and usually it's represented as a funnel. So there's all these ideas coming in, and they get funneled down to those ideas that are going to be developed. And basically at that level, there's two things. There's a theme and an epic. So a theme is, you know, it's called portfolio. So you're doing portfolio management. You're giving certain percentage to this segment of your business, another percentage to another segment of your business, another segment, and those are called the themes. And then within a theme for a certain kind of product line within your business, then you might have epics, very large things that you need to get done as an organization that is going to be decomposed into features. So the idea is that Leffingwell has, but now he's starting to change his model, is that the idea he had at first was, well, that would also be a Scrum team with a backlog, and they're producing something at an abstract level. But now he's introduced into his model the idea that maybe you'd use Kanban at that level. So
the tech roadmap an example of?
A tech roadmap, well, okay, so we're getting to that point. So at the portfolio level, he also says that there is an architecture team. And the architecture team would be creating that tech roadmap that you're just mentioning. And so there's two things happening. One is the new product ideas that are going to be funneled down into the products. And then there's the architectural roadmap that's going to be levied on the products and on the actual software which is developed. So this is kind of the, you know, this is the big picture, you know, in this largest, you know, most abstractly put, right? So now we're going to see the big picture itself as Leffingwell has it on his website. Oh, wait, not yet. There's another point to this. Yeah, go ahead.
Just one question about the big picture. You're talking about portfolio as being sort of the top of the pyramid.
Right.
What about the notion of instead of a portfolio, you've got a system of systems, and now you're involving multiple corporations making a contribution to a system of systems? Can it scale that big?
He doesn't go there. He doesn't go there, but that's a good point.
This is the thing we face in the DoD world, you know, when you talk about systems where you've got all kinds of contracts.
Sure, sure. Yeah, he doesn't go there. He's talking within one enterprise.
Within one enterprise.
Yeah, one enterprise. So let me just go back because I've forgotten that the... So you notice over here there's these narrative levels of epic, feature, and story, right? So one of the key things in his book is to do an entity relationship diagram that says how these things are related to each other. And this is kind of like what he sees as his major contribution to this in terms of specifying what the levels are, right? And so you have this strategic theme with the epic and the feature and the story, and then that's related to acceptance tests, and these are backlog items that are related to non-functional requirements. So this particular one came from some working paper he did in 2007, and then this is what it looked like in 2009, and this is more or less what's in the book. I couldn't find a picture of what was in the book, so I had to rely on this one. But basically, he's added a few things to it, you know, saying that you have a story can be a user story or another work item, and you know, he's added a couple of things, more things into this entity relationship diagram. So, but this is the level of formalization that he's offering. So this is what this big picture looks like. And so the reason I gave you the schema before is that this is kind of complicated, right? And so in this picture, the idea is that these are all little icons, and these icons you can click on, and you'll get you know, some kind of narrative about each piece. And the thing is that it started off with very few little icons for people on it, and now there's quite a few more. So this thing is evolving quite quickly, and the point about it is that I think the reason that this is successful is that, you know, people in an organization who's going to undergo this big organizational change, they look at this picture and they say, I want to be that guy. Right? So like one of these large organizations that I knew about, they just eliminated project managers as a role, right? And so then who are you, if you're a project manager, you're going to wonder, well, what am I going to be in this new world of agile at scale? And so you'd look on this diagram and find someone. And so I think that's where the popularity of this comes from, because you notice that, you know, I mean, basically all that's on this diagram are artifacts and roles within the organization. And it has some indication of flow here. So anyway, we'll go through this a little bit. You know, so here's a scrum team here with the product owner and the scrum master, right? And so you have multiple teams here, and they have their backlogs, and they are producing in iterations in those backlogs. And then he builds in that you have some kind of hardening epics, you know, at the end of your series of iterations, and the idea is these teams are going to produce their products in a way that allows them to synchronize. And so that's where you look up here, you see that there's something called the Agile Release Train, and he uses the metaphor of a train leaving the station, and the idea is that on this train is going to arrive at a certain point in time, and we need to figure out what that point in time is that we're all going to come together. So in order to do that, you can see that he has a roadmap and a vision, and you know, he has his product management and people supporting release management. But this group has their own backlog. And so and what's in those backlog are descriptions of features that would be added to the product incrementally. And so, you know, you know, he has an architect and you know, user experience person and a release train engineer he's got. And then the systems team, I was going through this diagram today and clicking on the various features and reading some of the stuff. And this systems team is really the system test. people, the people who are going to integrate the software and test the system as a whole.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In a Scrum world, what is an architect exactly? It's architecture, it was EAs up there. What is their role? What do they do exactly?
Okay, so the idea is that if you have a large organization and, you know, I mean, the way things are working in business today is that we're changing technologies very rapidly. And so the thing is that if you have several product lines and they're diverging in their technology, that's not good, right? So someone has to be in the company responsible for the direction that the company as a whole is going to go in terms of its adoption of technology.
One person, typically?
Well,
one visionary.
Well, no, I think that usually it's a team of people, usually drawn from the different products, you know, but they're given the
full-time roles.
Yeah, I think they're full-time roles. I've seen them as being full-time roles where they basically what they're doing. What I saw was that they were looking at the direction that the company wanted to go in terms of its architecture, and then they were levying on projects to, you know, not just do their own features, but to implement some new technology that other projects could use. And so there's a timeline there for integrating these new technologies in downstream projects. And so basically they, you know, the team I saw doing this, they were managing that delivery to downstream projects of new technologies. And so that's what you get up here at the top. You have these investment themes, and then you notice the red ones. Those are supposed to be the architecture at the portfolio level, and then the blue ones are supposed to be the ideas. And you notice in these backlogs, there's red little boxes. So that's the architecture flowing through the system. And that's one of the main things that he's trying to get across in his book. You see, the thing is that Agile has deprecated some things, you know, like it's deprecated documentation, right? It's deprecated requirements, deprecated architecture in a lot of cases. And so the thing is, what he's trying to do is say, hey, for a really big program for an entire organization, you're going to need those things anyway. And so he's saying that the requirements are going to flow through the backlog as these narratives at the different levels, but we also need architectural epics and features and stories to flow through that backlog as those backlogs as well, so that those things will be developed by the organization. Because the whole idea is to coordinate the architectural rollout within the organization and deployment, and that's what he's trying to get at here. And so he's bringing back the fact that, you know, we need to concentrate on the requirements and for very large projects, and we need to concentrate on the architecture at a high level for the whole organization.
So that's where tight points between these agile enterprises would occur, where you make sure that you're going to be synchronized and come together.
Yeah, that's the ideal. So
are there any tool sets that are beginning to support this kind of structure?
Well, okay, so there's a lot of tools out there that are for agile teams to do their storyboards and things like that. Mm-hmm. So those same organizations are starting to look at this kind of, you know, cross-organization
that
coordination.
That screams for a tool set.
So yeah. Yeah.
Like the SDRC.
Yeah, one of the challenges for the agile is that since it's a dynamic, it's changing the requirement. So how do you actually incorporate the change of the requirement that's coming in this kind of framework?
Well, okay, so the idea is here that all of these levels are agile in their own way, right? And so basically they're all going to be doing iterations of a certain level. I think the iteration for the top level is quarterly, right? And so then the iteration at this level is the release planning schedule, right? That at the product level, whatever they decide, they need the work to be done in order to support a release. That would be their equivalent of an iteration. And then these guys are working at 2 week to 4 week intervals. And so the idea is that the idea from Agile is the requirements can change, right, at the end of an iteration, right? So basically for the top level, it's quarterly in the organization, right? At the middle level, it's whatever the release planning cycle is telling you your next release is, you'll be able to change your requirements. Say the market changed in that period of time. Does that answer your question? So that's the other thing, is the idea that, there's lots of ideas embedded into this big picture. One is transparency, the idea that the teams at the low level have to be transparent. Well, how about these teams at the higher level? And then a lot of times these guys are not working as teams. They're working as individuals with their own domain rather than as teams. So the idea is that they would be working as teams as well and be as transparent as these guys at the lower level. So that way, these guys have some idea of what's coming because they can see what's in that backlog.
Mm-hmm. So in theory, the two should all allow everybody to tap into their architecture details so that they're working with a common base.
Right. The idea is to make it visible. And then everyone, you know, there could be multiple of these product level layers, right, which have their slice of the portfolio up there, but they can see what's coming at the portfolio level by looking at the epics that are there. So that's more or less the idea of this big picture. Any other questions about this thing?
Sorry, it's a runway.
Okay, so the idea is that. You notice there's a little jagged line here at the bottom. This is basically the work on the architecture getting done by these teams down here to build the technological infrastructure in. So the idea is that at the top, actually I don't see it on this diagram, but. The thing is that there's an architectural vision document that's supposed to be at the top level, right? And so basically this runway is saying, okay, how are we going to deploy that or roll that out in time? And then basically the idea is that the teams are going to be working on it. These individual teams are going to be working on little pieces, and little pieces are going to get done along with features as they do their iteration.
Mm-hmm. When a project is first starting, I can imagine the top group actually having a very rapid type of thing as you're trying to close in on the global big picture features of mm-hmm. The thing that you're going to be doing. And so it might be iterating much faster than once a quarter type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that once you're rolling along, I can understand the quarter concept. But I think when projects are starting,
well, right, I didn't mean to say that those guys aren't doing anything. What I meant was they're going to reconsider the themes in the portfolio once a quarter, right? They're going to have a year plan probably, right? But then they're going to reconsider their allotment of the percentage of the budget once a quarter. And a lot of times these releases are scheduled to be once a quarter as well. And so, there might be a 5-year plan out there, but we're only going to do the first year in detail, and then we're going to reconsider that allotment of resources. Okay. So, not working. Okay, so in this briefing, basically, what I do is I address some questions like, so who or what should be, what on the client side is targeted to be changed, right? So the team level, normal scrum teams are assumed to be in place here. And then what we're gonna do is we're gonna reorganize product management, product management into product owners, right? The product management's going to have a structure of product owners. And then they're going to have their own backlog with features in it. And then eventually we're going to reorganize the portfolio managers into a scrum team with their own backlog of themes and epics. And we're going to organize an architecture team to produce the technology improvements and infrastructure epics. He's kind of changed this last thing into having more Kanban at the portfolio level, as you saw on the slide. So this is more what he was saying in the book. So Kanban has to do with just looking at the, have you ever seen these things called Kanban boards where you basically the product is going through stages in its development and you make it visible by having some kind of tokens, post-its or something, moving along when these various parts are complete, the various, say, stories are complete. You would have them moving along through the various stages. So like at the portfolio level where he's suggesting that Kanban being used, there's supposed to be a funnel where the ideas come in. So you might have, all ideas that have been submitted, and then you might have analyzed ideas, and then, ideas where we think we can make a business case for them, and then ideas that are approved to actually be done by the organization. There might be a board like that shows you how things are flowing in the organization, and that's a way to make things transparent, make it so that everyone can see what's being considered and what's being done. So the key issues in the change, so the need to deliver epics and features in a timely manner so people working on stories can maintain their cadence. I think this is the driver for making that change. But another thing is to provide an agile-friendly organizational environment to support teams. The way things are now in most organizations is that, you have these agile teams in pockets, right? But the organization itself is operating the way it always did, right? So it's not operating in an agile way itself. And so there's some disconnect there within the organization between the agile teams and, the non-agile organization. So the idea here is to address that problem. And then, the third key to the change is the need to make all levels of the R&D transparent and lean. Lean means make it more efficient, get rid of the waste in the process. What, in a nutshell, does the agile organization look like after the transformation is complete? So you're going to have Scrum teams with their own backlog at all three levels of abstraction. And so this is the main thing that's being introduced here, is the idea, in Agile, if you look at the Agile manifesto, they say, well, we want to produce working code. Well, what's the equivalent of working code at these higher levels of abstraction? That's always a problem to say what it is. Mm-hmm. And maybe we would describe it as actionable, in other words, the idea has been developed enough that we can take action on it at the next level down of abstraction. So that's what he's trying to do, is define what Agile would be at these higher levels of abstraction and then what the levels of abstraction ought to be. So you'd have release planning functioning with synchronization between teams on large projects. And this is, I must say, I think the emphasis of his work, because basically you have a lot of Agile teams, but having them work on large projects together, some of that might be a new idea, something that's just really coming to fruition within the industry. So he's concentrating on that. If you look at his book, that's like the main thing that he's concentrating on. So, but another idea here is that the whole organization has a sustained cadence. So it's not just that the individual teams have a cadence, but the whole organization at these different levels of abstraction have a cadence. And this is what I think is one of the key points to what he's done, is that he introduces a common vocabulary and a vision of how that organization is going to function after the transformation. And so this gives people something to coordinate on so that they can make this kind of change in the organization. So what are the key steps of the process of transformation? So at the time I created this briefing, I didn't know of any steps that he had within his model for that. But recently he's added something to that, and we're going to look at that in a second here. So this is kind of a diagram where he sees, the stages by which he would introduce this into an organization. And, the first stage is to create some kind of agile center of excellence. And then, of course, he's going to train people in this agile framework. And he's setting up an academy and to train consultants, but also to train people within organizations. And then basically, he's going to introduce agile release trains here, and he's going to introduce lean thinking from Reinertsen up here. And he has training programs for these two groups of people. And then the idea is that, the organization is going to be able to make that change by having this kind of mentoring, so he's saying there's consulting and there's coaching and there's training and there's tooling to go along with this process.
Does he make any point that the flow is not expected to ever cease?
Yeah, that's the whole idea, is that right now, basically. Most organizations, they have this one-year plan and nothing changes.
Yeah, after that.
Once you've got that plan in place, your budget is fixed for the year, right? He's saying, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. Quarterly, we're going to look at it and see whether or not we're going in the right direction. So he's trying to introduce agility at higher levels of the organization, but of course that's difficult to do, because the organizations are bureaucratic and so this is a big change for we have organizations that came out of World War II, that's what we've got, is top-down command and control type organizations. And under this model, they would look very different in the future.
But they're also tied to other organizations. Like in my industry, we're tied to how our government contracts are structured. And
right.
And how we're going to be getting money. And all those kinds of things are all locked in.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out how to fit within whatever that model is. I don't
exactly
think we have the freedom necessarily to rethink ourselves in
right
this way.
But there are some aerospace companies that are working on agile programs. At the mini conference, we had some talks from certain people in the audience about that. So, but anyway, since there wasn't any transformation process that I knew of, I decided to invent one. And so the first stage would be the alignment on the agile at scale big picture, and that takes some time, because the thing is that when the people go out and read all the books on agile, they all have different interpretations, and that has to be kind of brought together into a standard interpretation. Well, when they read this book, they'll have multiple interpretations of what he says, right? And that has to be go through a process of alignment too, in order to, so that we're interpreting the model the same way. But at least having a model is a good place to start. And then
I think a common interpretation would be everyone else needs to change.
Yeah, exactly. Not me, right? So the idea is to stabilize the functioning of the agile development production teams. So he would say that that's the number one thing you need to do. Until your teams are stable at the lowest level, you don't want to mess around with your organization, right? But that's not what people do. They decide overnight, we're going to change the whole organization. So reorganize product management into scrum teams and organize product managers into product management sub-teams is the next thing. And then establish the product management backlog of features. and provide the features at the rate necessary to sustain the cadence of the production team. So this is the key point that, you know, product management has to get to, is to make sure that their backlog is filled enough to keep those teams running. And this is a sign that Agile really means something, right? If you've got a, you know, if the teams can outrun the organization, that means that, you know, Agile's working in some sense, because they're being more productive than they would have been otherwise. And then establish the release planning discipline on the larger programs, coordinate the work of the product owners on the large teams, create scrum of scrums as necessary on large projects to coordinate between the scrum masters, and establish a program-wide cadence with synchronization. So those are the kind of, you know.
But I've always thought that the scrum of scrum is sort of a catch-all. If you're really doing that architecture piece properly, that should be taken care of by doing that.
Right, but see, the scrum of scrums should also be handling these impediments, right? I mean, there's certain impediments that are not going to be, you know, just local to the team, but have to do with the whole program and the way the whole program's going. So the scrum of scrums has another role of handling larger impediments. So, and then. He would say, once you've got that done, then when the programs start to outrun portfolio, then what you want to do is you want to reorganize portfolio management into a scrum team or use Kanban, and establish yearly planning cadence with themes, and establish portfolio management backlog with epics based on the themes, and then establish architectural oversight that produces the technical epics. Provide epics as a rate necessary to sustain cadence, coordinate among the programs within the organization, and then keep doing that. Maintain and improve the lean, agile, at scale organization functioning on these second generation lean principles. So I think this is basically what he's suggesting as a way forward. So what are the most important elements? So a common vision of what agile at scale transformation means, and the vision of the agile utopia for the whole R&D organization. So one of my takes on this is a utopian vision, right? We're saying what we're seeing what the organization would look like if everything was perfect and we were all agile, right? But there's a long way from here to there, and making that journey is not going to be easy, especially when you know that there's going to be a lot of hybrid approaches that are half command and control, half agile. You know, I mean, that's going to be happening in all these organizations. So another important element is the common vocabulary of agile concepts, and then bringing requirements, architecture requirements, and longer term planning back into the agile parlance. I think that this is a really important thing that he's trying to do. You know, organization around the release planning, organize around the release planning to make the large programs work by coordinating these agile teams, and then not conflicting with the major agile team processes and practices.
Yeah, I think auditability is really important. Being able to say, are the various teams playing? Are they meeting the requirements that they have to meet? Are, you know, where are we at any given moment? Where do I have to invest my effort? That kind of visibility to process and progress and that kind of thing is something I think it needs to be emphasized a little bit more.
Now, he does have a whole metrics side of this, you know, where he's assuming that there's going to be agile metrics to show not only how the teams are performing, but you know, how agile we are, as we're, you know, there a lot of organizations, they use spider charts with different, characteristics of agile and how far we've gotten along on that.
I'm just thinking more in terms of the requirements and constraints that these teams, their products have to meet, basically.
Uh-huh.
Making sure that they're actually compliant and those kinds of things.
Right, well, yeah, he doesn't really address the auditing part as far as I know, but one of the ideas here is the idea that, you know, you shouldn't have the difference between developers and testers. You shouldn't have the difference between QA organizations and the developers, or they should at least be integrated in to the teams. That's one of the ideas that they're trying to get across. So the idea is that the teams are supposed to be cross-functional and cross-trained rather than stovepiped. So, you know, I started looking at this from the point of view of an outsider, saying, okay, what's missing here? And one of the things that I think about it is that, you know, this safe big picture is what it implies. It's an overarching vision, but lacks many practical fundamentals to actually make it work, right? And so, and there's, you know, one of the things that Agile is reacting against is process models. So the idea is, let's throw out all the process models. But the thing is that, you know, he's creating a process in other terms, right? But there's no actual model there behind the picture. And so that can be a problem. And then there's no practice definition for the teams to coordinate internally and externally on the technical issues. And the framework doesn't actually address Reinertsen's flow principles. Now, I've noticed that that's changing. You know, if you click on those buttons, you actually do see Reinertsen's principles in some cases. But he's assuming, basically, that you're going to read the Reinertsen book and implement that, you know, as something behind the scenes. The portfolio level is very sketchy. Well, he's done a lot of work since I wrote that on trying to fill in the portfolio level. And then this no actual guidance on how to make the transformation to the end state, I still think that's a problem. But then again, I haven't been trained, right? I mean, there's this training process that you go through, and I haven't had that training process. No, I'm not certified. I am not certified. So, but that's good because I can give you an outsider's view. I haven't drunk the Kool-Aid yet. So the book is silent on the many of the important issues of practice. And then there's lots of interpretations of what that could mean. And then the technology to implement the backlogs is not addressed, but he's recommending the Rally tool. So they're one of the ones that are attempting to create tools at this higher level. But he was associated with Rally, so that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons that he's recommending that.
Is that the full company name, Rally?
Uh-huh, I believe so.
So it is rally.com.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Close.
One of the problems that I witnessed was that, you know, people focus on the backlogs. They don't tend to read the whole book. He has a lot of meat in this book on how to do these things that he's talking about, but what you see is a myopic kind of focus on the backlogs and how the backlogs work. But, you know, that's a very important part of it, but it's good if people try to, you know, see more of, you know, the practices he's suggesting. But the key point is the book is just the tip of the iceberg of what's needed to make a change like this in the organizations that have been in place for years and years and years. You know, I mean, this is a huge transformation. So one of the things that I did was I looked at the work of Ivar Jacobson on practices. And you can see that there's a gap between what Ivar Jacobson is suggesting and he has a group called CMAT, which is cmat.org or something like that on the web, which is, you know, I think it's software engineering methods and tools, or methods and theory, maybe. But anyway, he has developed a process which is kind of like the open unified process. And And so he's suggesting some changes in our way of looking at software engineering. And so he has a book that's just recently come out called The Essence of Software Engineering. And basically what he's trying to do is he's trying to say, well, you know, software has some basic things that are common no matter how you're doing the software. And he thinks that we need to focus on practices. And so he has this thing, which he calls the kernel, which is the fundamental things within software engineering. And there are things like, you know, the stakeholders and the team and the, you know, the software system that we're building and the requirements. You know, it's about 8 things that he talks about as being the kernel. And basically what he does is he sets up a state machine with respect to each one of those things so that we can track where we are in terms of how, you know, like our requirements. Are they still ill-formed? Are they formed and approved? You know, a process like that. He talks about in relationship to these 8 things in his kernel. And so this is an interesting thing to compare to Leffingwell, because Jakobson wrote this article called Enough Process, Let's Do Practices. And so, you know, everybody that I've given this article to likes this article. I mean, it's, you know, people really do want to get away from processes. And so what Jakobson is trying to do is he's trying to say, what is the difference between processes and practices? And then his idea is that we should focus on the technical practices that we're actually doing on the teams. And the idea is that the teams would own their own practices rather than having procedures at the top that everyone has to follow. Instead, you have something that's more malleable where each team decides what practices that it's going to use and it follows those practices. And so this kind of gives a whole nother way of looking at the same area, because the idea would be that, you know, you have your team and you'd write down your practices as you need to communicate them to each other, as you need to communicate them to outside teams, and then you'd start an economy of these practices where, you know, a new project starts up, they need a practice, they go and, you know, choose from the practices of the other teams. And so I think this is a really interesting look at what might be happening at a much lower level in this reorganization process, because the thing is that if we're going to lighten up these procedures at top, we need to replace them with something else which is more flexible. So this is an interesting book that you might want to look at. And then another thing is when you start looking at the CMMI, right? I mean, a lot of us are used to the CMMI from aerospace and so forth. And a lot of it seems like exactly the same thing with a different language, right? And maybe a different approach. And in fact, what we see is that it's covering much fewer of the CMMI practices than we're used to covering. And so, but when you get into it, what you see is there's no real conflict between these things, right? And so another thing that needs to be looked at is, you know, can we do CMMI and the practices and put them in this kind of agile at scale context? And so the point is that there are teams that are operating at level 5 but doing it in an agile way. And they have incorporated into the last version of the CMMI, version 1.3, I can't think it is, the background comments about how you would look at these processes from an agile point of view. And so I listed the CMMI process areas. And what you see is that, you know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of them that are organizational level, right? And then there's very few that actually touch the agile team alone, right? But then there's this whole set of them that are in the middle that affect both the agile team and the agile at scale. And so, you know, this is an interesting perspective on how you get commonality, you know, but then how are we going to structure those processes so that the processes remain agile? They're not like, you know, laws that are written down by process people for engineers to follow. You know, that has not gone over well in industry. If you look at the other books, I've read most of these books on Agile at Scale. If you look at the other books on Agile at Scale, his is the easiest to digest, and it's a really good communication tool, you know, for the change agents, you know, trying to bring about a change like this. So, but it's interesting to read the other books that are available, and I'm sure there are going to be a whole plethora of them eventually as this, you know, becomes as more organizations get into this, you're going to get more authors saying, well, we ought to do it my way. So he's caught the imagination of many organizations who want to become agile at scale. And one of the reasons is that his book is very carefully written not to step on anyone's toes. So, you know, as you go through the book, it's interesting to see what is not mentioned, because anything that could be a matter of conflict, you know, is basically excised from the book. So he doesn't want to step on the toes of anyone who has their own agile method or anything like that. He wants to basically be mainstream as far as the bottom level is concerned, and you can do anything that you consider agile down at that level. And he's basically following the leaders in the industry in that respect. So that's an interesting thing about his strategy. So I think that, you know, whatever approach an organization takes toward you know, this agile at scale, it's good to remain you know, complementary with his approach, because his approach is now, you know, the most developed approach, and it seems like it's going to be the industry leader in that. And so there's going to be a lot of resources there to adopt. And the other thing is that it's a very sensible approach, I think. That's the reason that I like it, is that I feel it's reasonable. So, but I think that there's a lot of missing elements still, you know, that need to be filled in behind that big picture, and that's an opportunity. So the work that I've done is that, so now I'm going to kind of get into my own approach to these things. So back in 1995, you know, I was doing CMM, and I gave a presentation to the National SEPG on research I had done into process, because I was never a big fan of the Watts-Humphrey, you know, approach based on Deming, and I wanted to find alternatives to that. And I found some alternatives in socio-technical systems and so forth. And so basically I made a presentation, but I have another interest, which is complex adaptive systems theory. And I've developed a complex adaptive systems theory, which I call special systems theory. And so at that time, when I had just kind of discovered this thing I call special systems theory, I applied it to process in that presentation, right? And I wrote a paper about it. And so, but of course, you know, I gave it a couple of times at conferences, and then that was it. I was in aerospace. There was no agility in aerospace, and may never be, I don't know. But anyway, the thing is that when I got into the commercial world, right, I started seeing all of this agile stuff and realized, oh, they had invented stuff like I was talking about way back when. So basically I started studying it, and then I decided, you know, you've got values, and you've got principles, and then a whole bunch of practices that people are claiming to be agile, right? And so I was saying, well, there's no theory level there, right? And so I wrote a book called Agile Theory. And basically what I was doing was I was taking what existed in Agile and Scrum and applied it to my theory, see if it would fit. And so that worked pretty well. And then what happened was that I realized that, well, the key to this was to understand high-performing teams. So I wrote another book called The Foundations of Agile Teaming, and which talks about, in terms of this special systems theory, how high-performance teaming could work. And then what I did is I wrote another book called Lean Agile Systems Engineering. And basically what that does is says, okay, here's the theory. I'm going to tell you how Agile works and how Scrum works using the theory as a basis. And now I'm trying to work on a book called Lean Agile Scaling, where I'm trying to develop a theory based on my special systems theory. I'm trying to develop a theory of how you do scaling. Because in all of this work, there's no theories. Basically, this is all trial and error, people trying things. It seems to work in a particular case, and then they, you know, apply it to other cases until they find something where it doesn't work, and then they discard it. So the thing is that I went to, I did PhD at London School of Economics in philosophy of science. So the thing is that, you know, I'm really interested in theories and how theories work, and theories give you a lot of leverage over phenomena, right? I mean, with theories, you can explain things in deep ways. You can establish criteria, right? Right now, you know, since Agile is popular, everyone is claiming that their way of doing things is Agile. So how do you tell what's Agile and what's not Agile? Well, you need a theory to do that. And another thing is that with theories, you can predict things. So like when I'm working through the math of the theory, trying to say how that affects what I see in Agile and Scrum, sometimes it tells me, hey, there ought to be something there, but I don't see anyone saying that. So that's another thing that theory should do, is it should tell you, it should predict that certain things should be there. So unfortunately, these books are fairly unreadable, right? Because there are a lot of math in them. And so the thing is, the theory is very math-oriented, right? So, but basically what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to say, you know, Agile claims complex adaptive systems theory as one of its roots. Okay, I have a complex adaptive systems theory that I've developed over the years. Can I take that and explain why Agile works better than traditional processes? That's what I'm trying to do. And I think that a certain number of people will be interested in that, you know, that there is a theory here and we can go and test it. You know, the whole idea, according to Popper, is that you have to disprove theories. You can't prove them true. And so basically what you want to do is you want to develop a theory which is disprovable, right? So what I'm trying to do when I do this work is I'm trying to come up with theories that are specific enough that I can try to disprove them, you know, and so I think that's the goal, because once you get to that point, then you're doing science. You're not just making stuff up, right? And so that's kind of the goal. That's how we got here, where we are, right? We did science, and that involves experiment. It involves understanding the mathematical foundations of things. You know, it takes some hard work. But if we're going to make these huge transformations in our organizations, like Leffingwell is suggesting, it would be good to have some theory behind why we're doing these things, rather than just rumor or suggestions, or, you know, it worked over here, but it fails over here.
Along the lines of theory, have you thought about the notion of applying operating system theory to the management of the Agile process? If you know, down at the lower level, if you have an Agile team and you don't really want to perturb the team, the one part of an Agile team that could serve as the interface is that backlog. And if you have protocols established to manage the backlog, prioritize the items in the backlog, be able to change the order of the backlog, and, you know, have some protocols in place where, you know, the highest priority story that can be done is pulled out and done.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher levels have some control over that ordering. They don't perturb the team, they just mess with the list, then I think you might be able to execute control over the whole system the same way an operating system mm-hmm. executes control in a multitasking environment, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of theory and math behind operating system theory that could be applied
sure.
here.
Well, okay, so you're stealing my thunder. So, you know, I wasn't going to go into this, but because of what you said, I will go a little bit deeper into it, right? So, you know, you can look on my websites, and I've presented this special systems theory to some NCOSI conferences and some different conferences, and actually you can hear the talks that I gave. But to give it to you in a nutshell, okay, you've got systems, but they have an inverse dual, which I call a metasystem, right? That inverse dual is basically the operating system, right? It's the environment of that system. But the way that we look at systems now is we have a system and we think about it as if it was on a plenum, you know, just a flat black background. We're not concerned with the environment. But actually the environment is highly structured, right? Such that it has niches for those systems in it. And so the difference between a system and a metasystem is that the system is emergent and it's a whole greater than the sum of its parts, right? We've known that since Aristotle, right? But a metasystem is a whole less than the sum of its parts. That's what the operating system is, right? So we don't have any tradition that talks about these wholes that are less than the sum of their parts, but we know that sponges exist. I mean, there are things that have holes in them. And sure enough, those holes are niches for those systems to fit into. And so they act as filters on those systems. So that's what I'm using in this lean agile scaling. I'm trying to figure out how metasystems theory, which is basically operating systems theory, would allow you to understand how this scaling must occur within an organization. And I think I've come up with a theory about that. But let me just take you one step further, right? So we've got holes greater than the sum of their parts, which are emergent, and we have holes less than the sum of their parts, which are de-emergent. So that means that there must be this other possibility, which is holes exactly equal to the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. And that's what a special system is. Mm-hmm. And an example of that is a perfect number. A perfect number is a perfect sum of its parts. And so it turns out that in number theory, there are excessive numbers and deficient numbers. You know, there's numbers that you add up their parts and it's more than the whole. And then there's other numbers where you add up the parts and it's less than the whole, right? But there are perfect numbers and they're very rare. We only know about 46 of them. We've got computers running all the time trying to find new perfect numbers. But it turns out there's two other kinds of numbers like this. And one of them is called amicable numbers, where we've known about those since ancient times. And basically, that's two numbers that add up to each other, right? So the parts of this number add up to this whole, and the parts of this number add up to that whole. And those are called amicable numbers. And then in 1914, someone discovered something called sociable numbers, right? And so sociable numbers are when you have a ring of numbers, each one adds up to the next whole around the ring, right? So it turns out that perfect numbers are very, very rare. Sociable numbers are less rare, but still very rare. And amicable numbers, there's quite a few amicable numbers, but they're still pretty rare compared to all the other numbers that are either deficient or you know, what's the other word? Add up to more than the sum of their parts. So that, in a nutshell, is what special systems theory is about. What you got to do is you got to say, I've got a system. I need to do the inverse dual of that system, figure out what the metasystem is, which is like the operating system or the universal Turing machine. If this is a Turing machine, this is a universal Turing machine. And then between those two are special systems. And so basically, I use special systems in this theory, in agile theory and lean agile, to explain the hyper efficiencies that they claim for Agile. There are certain things that they claim for Agile, which are to be hyper-effective, to be hyper-efficient, to be able to sustain these cadences. And so I try to explain those with my special systems theory based on math. And then I try to explain the scaling based on what I call metasystems theory. So anyway, you can look at my website to see more about that if you're interested. But
I am. I mean, the idea here is that, and, you know, to sort of address your point about, you know, DoD systems and the government having this nasty habit of wanting to have visibility in the process from start to finish, sort of lends itself to the notion of operating system determinism, you know? So, you know, you don't have to have one operating system strategy for this Agile framework. You can have one that emphasizes determinism to satisfy our DoD customers, and you can have one that maybe wants to optimize on speed or throughput, you know, and will allow some non-deterministic behavior in order to gain the speed, and you know, that may be more along the lines of a commercial enterprise, or you know, one that's actually, you know, putting products to market or trying to make a market window.
Right. So we have a blind spot in our society because we call them operating systems, but they are very different from applications.
Yes.
And so we don't really differentiate in our academically or whatever between what operating systems do, which are universal Turing machines, and what the Turing machines do, which are the applications.
Right.
And so once you make that clear distinction between those two, then you can see the special systems as a possibility. But until you have figured out what the difference is between a system and a metasystem, special systems don't even exist.
Right.
So, anyway,
I can see that this is your baby, and that's a good thing.
Uh-huh.
Have you looked at your inquiry or your direction of inquiry as a solution to a societal problem at all? Because I think our societal problem is that with an economy, a nation, a world increasingly dependent on computer-aided whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we have almost a zero ability to make predictable large systems.
Right.
And keep them going.
Yeah, so with me, see, my whole emphasis all these years has been on just developing the theory, trying to find precursors and trying to figure out the math of the theory, right? So this is my first large-scale attempt to try to see, does the theory fit with anything in the world? And so far it's going okay. But the problem is that the audience for this is very, very narrow. The number of people who really want to know about the foundations of Agile are not going to be very many, right? But the thing is that this is a good test case, because it turns out that by applying it to this test case, I found a lot about the theory that I didn't know before. And so that's the value of doing, you know, applying to a test case. But as for larger societal issues, I mean, you know, the theory is published out on the web. If you've got any ideas, let me know.
but what I was getting at is it your intent that eventually this inquiry would lead to that?
You know, the thing is that I thought that trying to figure out how the theory worked was like too much to do. And so it's turned out that applying it to this one example is too much to do. So, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to get there personally. But that's why we have a tradition. We publish our results so that maybe other people will find them interesting, and, you know, maybe other people will do that. But there's a lot happening in the ecology realm that kind of addresses the kinds of things. Like, there's one guy who, a group of Australians, they have this thing called social ecological systems. And so they're trying to work on considering the ecology, which I would think of as a metasystem, and society, which I think of as a system. You know, I mean, if it's made up of specific organizations, you know, looking at them together as a system, and I think that's a very fruitful thing. So it's called social ecological systems. So 5 minutes? Okay, I'm going to quickly take you through this thing, which is basically what I did is I wrote a paper about Agile at Scale, and I tried to come up with my own take on it. And so one of the things I did was I replaced Leffingwell's big picture with a picture generator. I mean, you know, he has one big picture, but we could have a lot of different big pictures if we looked at the different roles and the different artifacts and so forth. And so, but another thing that I did was I did an analysis of Leffingwell's framework based on the book, and I found that I could create an operating system, like you're saying, that with just six kinds of work, I could maintain that backlog. So normally in organizations, there's like 70 kinds of work that people do when they're developing software. And so the fact that only six kinds of work can maintain these backlogs is makes it very efficient. And so that's one thing that I did, was looked at the kinds of work. And it turns out that with that data flow diagram, that can be at any of the three levels. One data flow diagram cover all the three levels. So that kind and this way of looking at things based on kinds of work comes from work by Jane Jacobs on the economy of cities. She talks about kinds of work. And so you can take Leffingwell's big picture and you can make a an analysis of it into what's happening at the as a data flow between these different kinds of work and vastly simplify the picture. And then we have all these principles, right? So another thing that you'll see on my website is a paper about practices and principles, because I wanted to try to understand what's the relationship between practices and principles. And I was especially wanted to understand it in relationship to practices because I didn't think that that Jacobson basically said, let's do practices, but he created another process. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to say, well, what is a practice? If we're going to ask people to change to practices, we really want it to be different. And I did an analysis, and I going back to Aristotle, you can see that he has very specific things in terms of his causation. You know, you have formal and material causes, they're kind of the process level, but these efficient and final causes are more at the practice level. And so you can get a very good distinction between what's at the process level and what's at the practice level. And I think that helps if we want to try to get people to adopt practices to say, no, they aren't processes, you know, they're something different. And it's something that we haven't emphasized, but Agile is trying to emphasize, so it's good to have a good definition of it. And then, so here's the various principles, and then here are the necessary kinds of work for doing systems or software. And then in my model, basically you have a bunch of constraints on your scaling, a bunch of dimensions of scaling, and then you have a lot of these Agile practices that can be trained in your organization. So you have the Agile training modules there. And then here, you know, we can apply patterns and protocols, right? And there are some really interesting books on organizational patterns that exist. And then you have the individual and team practices. So if you look at this, the you know, the big picture is just one element here. We really need to understand, you know, like you're saying, the operating system that is managing those backlogs. Basically, these kinds of work are requirements, planning, backlog management, release planning, development, and architecture. And so all of the other kinds of work that we would do, this whole hierarchy of maybe 70 kinds of work would happen in that development bubble. But you see that, you know, we need the picture, but we also need, like you're saying, the operating system. We need the some principles. We need to understand the kinds of work. We need to understand the dimensions of scaling that we're talking about. We need to know what these teachable practices are that we want our people to learn. And then we need to have pattern language and protocols and then the individual practices. So this is kind of my model for how you would fill in behind Leffingwell's big picture. So anyway, I think maybe I should stop there.
Yeah.
So any other questions? So there's just a few more slides which are more of these opportunities for improvement that I just mentioned.
Yeah. Had an opportunity to present at our CAD thing this year.
Oh, cool.
My topic was systems managed enterprise, which looks a lot like an agile process because that's my view of systems engineering to some extent. And I just thought it was interesting that there's a lot of commonality here. But the thing I really was emphasizing, which I didn't see too much discussion on, was the collaboration models that are required to make this kind of play. Maybe this is that operating system part that we're talking about. What is the information flow back and forth, and how is that all working? How do we stay synchronized, and how does that all really happen?
Right. Well, yeah. You know, like in his way of doing it, they haven't gotten to that level of detail. That's why I'm saying there's an iceberg there of things that need to be worked out. But of course, we want to do it in a way which is agile and not planned, right? So that's the problem, is that coming up with ways to make it adaptable and agile, not a specified interface that never changes, but something which changes over time so that we can claim at least to be agile.
I guess that would be always the challenge.
Yeah.
The one piece that I'm not, that, since this has such a similarity to organizational development, which actually was a specialty that I tried to apply to big system development, I don't see an input in your modeling for the human factors, kind of like what he was referring to as the what about the collaborative issues? There's a science in that. And an awful lot of how the organization gets structured needs input from
right. Well, I think that I write about that in the books that I was mentioning, the manuscripts I was mentioning, but I didn't put that in this. I think that's important. We need to look at that. What's interesting about this is that, this is like organizational change and development, only with a new terminology. Just like it's software engineering with a new terminology. Basically, I guess we got tired of our old terminology and now we want to rename everything and figure out what it is in this new world where we've renamed everything. The unfortunate thing about that is it causes a lot of confusion. So one of the things we want to do is we want to make sure that when we rename thing, we really mean something different. We're not just talking about the old stuff anymore, right? And so that's where theory comes in.
Hi. Spencer, by the way. I saw an article talking about Git and, version control, subversion and this kind of good thing. And in the article, it talked about, building Git using Git. And basically, how the company builds it is that, they have this product already, developed mostly. And, there's different things that come in and, someone just goes off, builds something, write a patch towards it, submits it, and then it just iterates, that kind of thing. Have you, thought about that or looked into that as a way to be agile, to scale up to bits of some type?
Well, I think that that's a, there's a lot of theory behind this idea of bootstrapping, right? Where, like Python's written in C, right? But then there's PyPy, where they've rewritten Python in Python, right? And so this bootstrapping thing is an important part of these kinds of systems, And so that's something we definitely need to pay attention to. But they haven't gotten there to, this is like a reflexive idea where we're, what do they call it, eating our own dog food or whatever. I mean, it's a terrible phrase. But anyway, the idea is that you use the tools to build the tools that you're going to use yourself, right? And so, we need to try to do that as we're, we're building these kinds of systems.
Would you be able to share those slides with me?
They're on my website, kentpalmer.name.
All right, if you don't have any other questions, as a token of the appreciation, so we'd love to present you. This is a nice pen.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you very much.
So every time you use that, you remember us.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So if you don't have any other questions, well, I want to thank you again for coming. So hopefully see you in other future events we're going to have. Thank you. You have a nice evening.
Thank you. Do you have your friends forward to you?
Are you associated with any research organization?
Anyone here is working in
the No, I'd like to be. If you could figure out how I could be, let me know.
I mean, have you been in academia?